Welcome back to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Russo. Coming up in just a bit, we'll take you to Chincoteague Island, where the community theater group is bringing new meaning to the phrase, keeping it local. We'll talk to the local director, the hometown playwright, and the adaptation of two very well-known stories about Chincoteague history that are the inspiration for these two plays. We'll explore how theater can bring folklore to life and teach us a little bit about history. But first, the Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA, recently approved a new pollution budget specifically focused on the Maryland coastal bays. The aim is to reduce phosphorus levels by 35% and nitrogen levels by 18% in our local waterways, specifically the Assawoman Bay, the Isle of Wight Bay, the Sinipuxent, Newport, and Chincoteague Bays, all, of course, in Worcester County. The EPA believes this plan will improve water quality and improve conditions for aquatic life and shellfish harvesting. But I wanted to learn more about the plan itself and find out how the EPA hopes to meet these goals. So I sat down this week with Dave Wilson, the executive director of the Maryland Coastal Bays Program. He says in the quest to clean up our local waterways, it's more of a marathon than a sprint.
Well, you know, as you know, the Chesapeake Bay has had a TMDL, which is a limit on the number of nitrogen and the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that can go into parts of the Chesapeake Bay for a number of years. We actually had old TMDLs, and again, this is a nutrient load limit, that were actually almost a decade old, and we were looking at updating those, making them more current, getting us reduction goals that were realistic that we could try to strive for, and know that those goals were goals that were accurate and would reflect what our real needs were. Mm-hmm. And so we actually were working with the Maryland Department of the Environment for the past actually about 5 years now to create these goals and look at the real reductions that we needed both north of the Ocean City Inlet and south of the inlet, because there are different sort of systems behind Ocean City and Assateague.
You and I have talked many times before about how the coastal bays and how this region has a phosphorus problem. Are these goals, 35%, 18%, viable?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's consensus, I think, between ourselves and all the partners that worked on this in the state and federal government that the numbers could be higher, but we also need them to be realistic. And so some of the data that was used from times when the water quality was a little bit better in the coastal bays. But the reality is some of these goals are so high, are going to be really hard to reach, that it almost doesn't matter how much work we do. We're going to be working on this for decades, whether it's 35% or 44% reductions. And so the area that we really are concerned with currently is the phosphorus. So we, in the past 7 or 8 years, we've had really high phosphorus levels, especially in the southern coastal bays. And they've really taken their toll on seagrass. Mm-hmm. So the high phosphorus numbers have made sort of an inhospitable environment for seagrasses, which where most of the is where most of the life, aquatic life, is in the coastal bays. And so we're going to work really hard with the farming community, which is already strapped in a lot of ways, but also with the urban runoff and other sources to reduce phosphorus as well as nitrogen, which historically was the big problem in the coastal bays.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because, you know, when you read this release and you read what the EPA passed down about this new move and this venture and this what this budget is calling for as far as reducing the phosphorus and nitrogen, what I didn't really see and what was a little bit unclear was the steps of how to get there. You mentioned, you know, the poultry industry or the farming industry, that has always historically been attached to the pollution that's created here in this region that impacts our waterways. You also mentioned the development and growth and stormwater and things like that. What are the first three steps in this plan to, you know, start working together with those two entities?
Well, there's good and bad news in this, and that is that we have a pretty good model in the Chesapeake Bay, which have had to have watershed implementation plans for the past 2 or 3 years. I think the county had to have those done mm-hmm. about 2 years ago. There is no such plan for the coastal bays. Coastal bays we often think of as the forgotten bays. But the good news is that we have a management plan for the coastal bays. We're in the process of really nearly finished updating that management plan with all of the local, state, and federal partners. So Ocean City, Berlin, Worcester County, State of Maryland, EPA have all been working for the past 3 years on our management plan for the coastal bays. And central to that plan is implementation of the TMDL. And so we we're actually having a meeting coming up here shortly where we're going to get a group of all those folks together as a subgroup of another entity that exists in the program to create a very specific targeted plan for implementing those TMDLs in all the sub-watersheds. So we're real excited about it. I know Worcester County, Ocean City, Berlin is excited because they want to be able to show that they're working on this with us. And I think they have sort of the will to do it. They understand how closely their economy is tied to tourism dollars and how important agriculture is. And I think we're going to come up with a plan that's maybe even better than some of the Chesapeake Bay WIPs because it's a very local plan and,
sure.
and it serves the needs of the local folks.
Is there a quick way to reverse it, or is this something that the public is going to see happening and slowly improving over a 10-year, 20-year, 30-year level?
Yeah, I mean, usually these kind of things, even when you, for example, we've had a number of point sources removed from the Northern Coastal Bays and from Newport Bay, which is considered a Southern Coastal Bay, we see immediate slight improvement after those point sources are removed. By point sources, I mean sewer outfalls. But then over time, you see a gradual improvement because those water bodies have been abused for so many years that it takes a long time for the pollution, particularly nitrogen and phosphorus, to cycle out of those systems. Over the long term, I think you're going to see, you know, if we can keep control on growth and don't let growth get too out of hand, which causes all kinds of problems for watersheds. If we can do that, I think we'll continue to see gradual improvement in the northern coastal bays. And I think with some really good work, especially from help from the feds in the southern coastal bays for agricultural land that we can sometimes convert to wetlands with willing landowners, of course, and put in additional buffers in some places. And farmers have shown a willingness to really want to do these things that create great wildlife habitat, but also pays them to enroll them in these programs. I think we're going to see improvement, but it will be gradual, and it does take time for these systems to recover, as we've seen around the world.
Do you think what we've seen in recent years is a direct impact of how quickly the Coastal Bays region grew from a development standpoint? I mean, we saw so many new things during the housing boom go up, and stormwater really wasn't a big, huge topic of mainstream conversation back then. Over the years, it's become a conversation. It's been brought up in Annapolis. Do you think that moves like this and other regulations are allowing the Maryland Coastal Bays to sort of catch up to the impacts that were left behind from the massive housing boom?
Well, yeah, there's no question about the critical area law. I mean, we were about 15 years behind the state passing that law in the Chesapeake Bay. We're not part of the quote-unquote rain tax, which deals with the western shore. But some of our local entities, like Berlin, have decided they're going to have their own stormwater utility and impose a small tax to pay for stormwater upgrades. And that has a multifold effect. It not only helps water quality in Newport Bay and Trap Creek, where almost all of Berlin drains, but it also alleviates flooding, because Berlin has a serious flooding problem. Ocean City has a serious flooding problem. And we've actually been meeting with town officials to talk about ways that they could produce some dollars to do some stormwater work in Ocean City. And even though Ocean City is at sea level, they can still do a lot of work to treat stormwater before it falls into the city and drains out into all the bays. Because right now, almost all the water that falls in Ocean City drains out into the coastal bays behind Ocean City and Assateague.
That was Dave Wilson, the executive director of the Maryland Coastal Bays Program, talking with me about a newly approved pollution budget by the EPA that focuses on cleaning up the Maryland Coastal Bays. We turn now from the Coastal Bays to Chincoteague Island. Back in February, we introduced you to Chincoteague's Lone Theater Troupe and learned how a small group of thespians are breathing new life into the coastal community's art scene. Now they're bringing new meaning to the phrase local theater, producing two plays written by a local playwright who pulled inspiration from the pages of local history.
And I reckon someone took great care to find it real careful like. I hoped he'd make it over the waves and onto the beach. And that's how I found it just now. I told no one.
Well, get on with it, man. Goodness sakes, what is it? Merciful God in heaven. Can I believe my eyes? A boy child? It can't.
The plays are called Shipwreck and The Ballad of Jenny Hill. And the Chincoteague Island Theater Company will perform these two plays back-to-back on August 30th and 31st at the Island Theater in Chincoteague. Lexi Hubb is the director and founder of the Chincoteague Island Theater Company.
Well, the two plays are written by a local playwright named Lisa Cannon. She started writing these plays about 2 years ago. Shipwreck is about the discovery of James Alone, who was a young boy, maybe around two or three. In our play, he's a baby, because it's very hard to find a three-year-old who will cooperate on stage. The story is that a ship wrecked off the coast of Assateague, and he was bound to a hatch cover, and it washed ashore after a storm. And a family in Assateague Village found him and raised him as their own and named him James Alone. And he later changed his name down in Accomack to James Lunn and has many descendants here on Chincoteague. And there's a family tree on a scroll sort of thing of the lineage since James Alone. So, and they all have a distinct look. They all have black hair and olive skin and...
Just to give people a context of the time period, this is early 1800s, correct?
Yes, it's 1802. It's back when there was a community on Assateague, before the Assateague Lighthouse. It takes place in the Assateague Village. There, the resources were very limited, and people on the island would, when there was a shipwreck, which there were quite a few off the coast of Assateague, they would profit off of salvaging what was washed ashore and building their homes and kind of making a living off of that. That's where the Native Americans supposedly lived instead of Assateague, because you could farm much easier on Assateague than you could on Chincoteague.
Right. So tell me why James Alone's story is such a beloved part of local folklore. I mean, not only the way sort of he washed ashore, so to speak, mm-hmm. of course that's dramatic and that's good for theater, but as far as the stories being told, because I understand the plays were written through the telling of stories through mm-hmm. the generations. It's not like mm-hmm. there were journalists back then.
No, there were no journalists documenting this. There's no first-hand documentation of this story. It's all told by word of mouth throughout the generations. And the community kind of comes together over this because it's a large group of people who could connect based on one thing. Mm-hmm. They're all connected without even trying. And it's kind of unique about them that they, a lot of people who settled this part came from England and, and Scotland, and this is different. They came from Spain and possibly, if the folklore story is correct, they came from Spain or, and they looked different and, and it kind of makes them a little bit more unique than maybe other people who were here and settling here.
Talk to me about how you took something that many people in this community, they know the story, or they mm-hmm. know a portion of the story, or a version of the story mm-hmm. as it's been passed down through the generations. How do you take all of those maybe different variations of the theme and turn it into theater that really, the community can rally around and enjoy?
Well, Lisa wrote a really good script, and she talked to a lot of people and interviewed a lot of people and read a lot about James Alone and the descendants and Assateague life and whatnot. And she always stated ahead of time that these were kind of her interpretations of this story. It doesn't mean it's right or wrong or everything else is right or wrong. She took everything and kind of interpreted it her own way. She got in contact with a lot of descendants and invited them, and we even had like a little moment where we showed the scroll and brought the descendants up, to the front of the stage and just kind of celebrated that. And so a lot of people liked that because it kind of, made them, shine a little bit at that particular moment.
But while Shipwreck is a play that shines a light on a celebrated part of Chincoteague's rich history, The Ballad of Jenny Hill tells one of the darker tales. Lisa Cannon penned both of these plays. She retired to Chincoteague Island with her husband a few years ago. But she says these plays sort of, in a way, wrote themselves.
I've been coming to Chincoteague more than half my life, and I've always been interested in Chincoteague history. I never imagined writing plays about it, but when I retired and my husband and I moved here, I started really reading a lot of history, and these stories spoke to me, and I feel as if I just sat there and was a scribe, because the voices just came to me.
Tell me how you approach both of those stories.
With Shipwreck, the story of James Alone, and no one really knows very much detail about who actually discovered him, who actually adopted him. That is lost to history, and he really doesn't come into history until he's age 20 and he goes to the Accomack courthouse. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I thought of these people living on Assateague in 1802, subsistence living, I'm sure, how it might be so joyful to them to have a child come to them. And in my mind, rather than being a burden, it would seem very much like a blessing. With Ginny Hill, it was, why did this tragedy happen? Yeah. And my whole idea with the Ballad of Ginny Hill was everyone contributed to the tragedy. Tom Freeman committed the crime, but in a way, in my mind, everybody was somewhat guilty in contributing to a situation that evolved. So looking at each of the characters and a little bit more of each character's motivation, mm-hmm, was what I had in mind in expanding. And that play is almost twice as long, yeah, as the original.
When you sat down to write these two plays, knowing that local history is beloved and almost guarded here on the island, did you feel like you were going to get some pushback at any point when writing them, when you had to take sort of liberties or you know, make adaptations based on what we know in history to make a play and have theater in that? Was the result the same as what you anticipated?
I wasn't sure anyone would come to see these plays. I felt inspired to write them. But whether anyone would really come to see them, I was very nervous and I had my doubts. And I did have a little concern about taking family stories and using them creatively. Mm-hmm. But both these stories are so much out in the public domain, for right, one thing. I did some checking about that issue with Miles Barnes, who's the preeminent historian of the Eastern Shore of Virginia. And he was reassuring to me that, yes, I have the right to do this. And, of course, you treat the material respectfully. Mm-hmm. And, again, with the Ballad of Ginny Hill, no one is singled out as being the villain. Yeah. No one is being condemned. They're all acting out of what they think are the right motivations, but they're all unknowingly contributing to this tragedy. Yeah. And I wanted the audience to kind of see it coming.
What do you think that audiences will take from these two plays as far as learning something new about a story maybe they've heard numerous times before?
I think it's really ultimately about the courage of people who lived in such a place, so isolated for so long, and the resilience. That's a word you hear a lot about Shinkatigers, but I think it's really true. And even in the case of Ginny Hill, I mean, the family picked up and went on. I hope for Tigers it's respecting, reminding them about appreciating their own history and respecting the struggles of people who came before them, yeah, and people who survived.
That was Lisa Cannon. Her two plays, Shipwreck and The Ballad of Ginny Hill, will be brought to life August 30th and 31st at the Island Theater in Chincoteague Island, Virginia, by the Chincoteague Island Theater Company. We also heard from the company's director, Lexi Hubb. You can learn more about the plays and how to get tickets for the shows at our website, wamucoast.org. You're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City and 88.5 in Washington. I'm Brian Russo. Have a great weekend.